C.S. Lewis was successful as an apologist and as a writer of imaginative fiction, not despite his day job, but because of it.
Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm your host, William O'Flaherty. I'm also the author of two books related to Lewis. Learn more details about them at the end of the show. On the podcast today is Jason M. Baxter, author of The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, a book new for 2022. This is his first time on All About Jack, but he has written several other books. Welcome to All About Jack, Jason.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, now, many people jump into a book by starting with the first chapter, but I believe your introductory material is vital for most, if not all, who want to benefit from your topic. In fact, your subtitle, How Great Books Shaped a Great Mind, is in some sense an expansion, or your introductory material is an expansion of that subtitle, at least that's the way I took it. So give us a snapshot of your introduction and why you lay the foundation that you do there.
Yes, I'm glad you liked the introduction. I think I like it more than anything else in the book. And I think basically I just try to get off the point very quickly that C.S. Lewis was successful as an apologist and as a writer of imaginative fiction, not despite his day job, but because of it. And I think that comes as a shock when, you know, I think if you just say, hey, C.S. Lewis was a don at Oxford, I'm like, okay, get it. And you really, you know what he was doing, right? He was staying up late at night and consulting Middle English dictionaries and teaching himself strange, you know, medieval dialects of French, or like Occitan and Provençal. And he was concerned with the details of textual transmission. And he read these treatises, which not even a college professor would inflict on his students. Right? And he's reading these things in manuscript form. He's reading them in libraries. And it seems to everyone, if you go and read some of these things, that's not my Lewis. How could my Lewis possibly derive anything of use from that? And so that's what the introduction is about, is first of all, how Lewis's day job influenced his writing and how it's not like he just sort of left his thinking at the office, but sort of these thoughts of medieval cosmology, these thoughts on medieval chivalry, these thoughts on what I call the iconicity of the world, or what Lewis calls it sacramentalism, were constantly with him. Whether or not he was writing his books or even writing personal letters to people like Sheldon Van Auken. So in essence, I think you could say Lewis is the new Boethius, or the British Boethius, as I put it in the introduction, by which I mean two things. One, he was concerned with, as he said in one lecture on apologetics, trying to vernacularize all of his theology. That is, trying to take some of these learned concepts he was finding in his medieval books, these ancient debates of sort of scholasticism and these difficult technical features, and put them in a way to make his audience feel that they actually mattered and counted. And secondly, like Boethius, this, I know we'll get into it here in a bit, but this 6th century Roman author called the last of the Romans or the first of the medievals, Boethius was interested in, as Lewis put it, of trying to show how much authors from Homer to Plato to Virgil to Seneca had in common. Analogously to that, Lewis, in a phrase that I coined, practiced the long Middle Ages. That is, he was interested in showing how much the old authors had in common. So his vernacularization, as well as his focus on the unity for what he thought was a new age of barbarism, make him a kind of 20th century Boethius who's trying to rescue the Western classical tradition analogous to how Boethius had done some 1500 years before him.
Well, now, because my background is not in literature in general, let alone medieval authors, names like, mentioning Boethius several times here, or even like Dante, they bring to mind only like secondhand information about them or their works. So go ahead, and if you can provide a quick summary about them and maybe some of their essential works.
Yeah, this is a fun question. I think, okay, we'll start with Boethius. 6th century Roman author, comes from an aristocratic family. and was one of the patricians, was a senator, but was living in a time in which the Ostrogothic king, Theodoric, had taken over the handles of the government of Rome. In essence, Rome had collapsed, but it still had these kind of survivals of the ancient Roman Senate. And Boethius, in the middle of this, is a Greek reader, which is a problem because Theodoric's great enemy is the Eastern Byzantine Greek-speaking empire. And so even just reading Plato and Homer and so forth comes under suspicion. Boethius is imprisoned. He's executed after 2 years. And it cuts short all of these extraordinary intellectual ambitions that Boethius had. While he's in prison, though, he writes his Consolation of Philosophy, in which in about, 105 pages, he tries to compress a whole lifetime of intellectual ambition. Now, that piece, the Consolation of Philosophy, Lewis loved it. In fact, Lewis thought that it was a litmus test, that what side of what he called the great divide you were on, if you're more medieval or more modern. And that is a very, the first couple of books of Consolation of Philosophy, book one and book two, are pretty easy. Because this is where Boethius gives his lament. This is where he expresses those very understandable human emotions about the failure, the tragedy, the grief of his life. And his visitor, Lady Philosophy, his allegorized kind of spiritual physician, begins to help him think through this and feel through this. And that's book one and book two are kind of fun. But then it starts to get a little bit more difficult. It gets a little bit more abstract. It gets a little bit more dialectical. And by the time Lady Philosophy is done with the poor old prisoner in book five, she's making some extraordinary distinctions, say between time and eternity and fate and providence. And it's a tough read. But one of the fascinating things about this book is called a prosimetrum. That is, it goes from prosa or prose to metrum or poetry. And so it sort of alternates back and forth. And as some scholars have recently pointed out, the poetry, in a way, is kind of a literary liturgy. It's a poetic therapy. It helps sort of retune the soul so that it can even be put in a position to care about the arguments. How Lewisian, if I may, how C.S. Lewis-ish is that? Right, that you, in some sense, need to use the imaginative vehicle of literature to put the soul in a state where it's even receptive to rational argument. I feel like that's one of the constant themes, right, of Lewis, is that so many of our choices are made at a deeper level of the will, even though we pretend that we're being very rational and intellectual. Dante was a 13th and 14th century Florentine poet. He began his life as a love lyric poet. And you have to remember that Lewis's first academic book, 1936, I think, mm-hmm. Allegory of Love, was dedicated to trying to rehabilitate this ultra weird genre of lyric poetry. And I know it's weird because I teach at a Christian college. And when I read it with my students question my judgment of whether or not I should be exposing this stuff to them. But just like what Lewis would do for the astrological medieval planets, as Michael Ward has explored, he first did for the whole genre of allegorical love poetry. I know it's stuff that we find so weird that it's almost concerning. Lewis felt the need to rehabilitate this stuff. So Dante began as one of these weird allegorical love poets in his youth, in his 20s. In his 30s, he did what you're supposed to do. He became mature and started working for the Florentine government in this disastrously divisive two-partied system, and was exiled by his enemies. At first, he thought this was the greatest disaster of his life, but then he realized that actually being in exile, as painful as it was, as homesick as it made him, as nostalgic as he was, gave him a unique access into longing for heavenly things. He was sort of exiled from his not only his mother country of Florence, but his, I guess you could say, his father country of heaven. And that's when the great sort of moment in Dante's life happened. He stopped writing the little love lyrics And he started writing this incredibly ambitious story of his journey all the way down to the bottom of hell, and then out and through to the other side in what he would have thought of as sort of an Antarctica, a purgatory, in which Christian virtues are perfected, or as I like to say it, head knowledge becomes heart knowledge. And then, in an anticipation of Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, there's some medieval sci-fi space journey in which Dante floats up with his guide, Beatrice, and they go through the various heavens and have conversations about deep spiritual realities. That's Boethius and Dante, both of whom massively influenced Lewis.
Okay, great. Well, now then, you know, what are some of the ways, and you've touched on it in certain aspects, the impact they had on Lewis, or in what ways can we see their influence in his works?
When you know Boethius and Dante, I am just continuously surprised and elated to discover how often they show up just beneath the surface of Lewis's writing. And sometimes even in which you think Lewis is being the most modern. I give the example in the introduction of Lewis's wonderful essay on living in an atomic age, and which was obviously being circulated everywhere in 2020. Mm-hmm. As people pointed out, you could just do a find and replace search, right? Replace atomic age with age of pandemic, and you've got an essay which makes a lot of sense for our world. Anyway, it felt really up to date. It felt really modern. It was really pastoral, wise, sage counsel. Well, come to find out, Lewis, in the best possible way, I mean this term, plagiarized Boethius's book 2, in which he talks about Lady Fortune. Now, in his image, you remember the Wheel of Fortune made famous by dear old beloved Pat Sajak. But before old Pat Sajak and Vanna White, there was Boethius's Wheel of Fortune, which basically describes the mixing and matching and eternal or perennial movements of worldly goods. Some nations are wealthy, and then they fall into decline. Some nations are emerging, some nations are declining, and this happens on the level of families, and also happens in even in the level of, you know, your individual human life. You have good days of health, you have good decades of health, you have bad decades of health, you have lucky moments and unlucky moments, and so forth. Boethius is writing about this in the 520s. And Lewis thought that, look, if we could recover that kind of spiritual insight, it might help us ungrasp our fingers on the expectations of what we are owed. And then, as he says in his Atomic Age essay, then we'll be less surprised and more sort of open to this experience of living in the Wheel of Fortune. Anyway, he doesn't mention Boethius by name, but if your listeners go read book 2 of Boethius and then go read that essay, you'll see a little example of what I'm talking about. Another example, C.S. Lewis's wonderful, wonderful Weight of Glory. Part of my argument is that Lewis borrowed, in addition to the scriptural phrase, Lewis borrowed a very interesting metaphor from Dante. There's a moment in which Dante is being tried. He's being examined almost by sort of college professors in an oral exam for a student. And he's being examined on whether or not he has the virtues, the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity. Well, when he comes to one of these examinations, Dante says he looked up at his quote-unquote professors, and he felt the weight of their holiness. And he said it reminded him of those times where you come really close to mountains which are unusually steep, unusually close to the perpendicular, such that the mountains feel weighty just by looking at them. And that's how Dante describes this experience of holiness. I think that's one of the things that Lewis loved so much about Dante, is the sense of, I guess you could say, viscousness or heaviness or gravity or weightiness of holy and heavenly things. And that's something that he borrows from Dante, I think, even in that sermon, but especially in his imaginative literature, in which he tries to make holiness and love, these things are very hard for us to imagine in our mechanized world that prefers quantity and data to quality and spiritual realities. Lewis got that from Dante as well, that sort of peculiar poetic talent of using metaphors and weightiness to try to communicate holy things. We could keep going, but I suppose I would just be reading the book to your listeners.
All right, well, that's good. Now, of course, those authors are not the only ones that Lewis read. You don't have to give an exhaustive list, but just, you know, what are some of the maybe lesser known medieval works or authors that Lewis admired and that influenced him?
Yes, well, I've already mentioned these strange medieval love lyric poets, but I think probably the weirdest book, and I'll admit it, I have inflicted this at least a couple of chapters on my students, and they think it is the strangest thing they've ever read in their life, stranger than sort of magical realism or anything being produced in the past couple of decades. The Roman de la Rose, it is a sort of a book of joint authorship in which one author, Jean de Mun, tried to finish what a previous author had begun, and it is really strange. It's an allegory of a soul that all of a sudden he sort of wakes up and it's springtime and he goes into this enchanted garden and he falls in love with a rose because love is stalking him and shot him in the heart through the eyes 7 times. Already my students are thinking, what are you doing? But then it's 300 pages of strange dialectical conversation that goes on from there. Lewis jokingly at one point describes it as sort of, you know, Dantesque, Dante-like, except failed. And it's just this big, massive thing that Dante did well and the previous author had done poorly. So again, this is one of those moments where you think, how could our Lewis possibly have learned anything from this? But Lewis says that he says it, you know, almost everywhere in his writings. He loves the garden scene of Roman de la Rose and how it's described as this formal, ornate garden, which is almost kind of steeped in happiness and steeped in joy. And Lewis said, look, if you think about that garden, that gets us so much closer to a good idea of heaven than our sallow, sickly image of a bunch of angels playing on guitars, sitting on clouds and wearing white robes. So even this weird text like Roman de la Rose impressed itself on Lewis's imagination, its color, its formality. Again, I guess you could say its density, almost sort of like strong, oh, perfume odor of joy. So Roman de la Rose, arguably even weirder, and this I have not inflicted on my poor students, is Bernard Silvestri's Cosmographia. It is also, like Boethius, a prosimetrum. It switches back and forth between poetry and prose. And it is a kind of a strange allegorical story of creation. It's Christian, but it borrows a lot from pagan terminology. For example, they don't call God God, they call God nous or intellect. And it's the story of nature who goes and complains about the state of chaos of the world. And nous comes to her and says, okay, I will let you go on a space journey. You can go up through the celestial heavens and you can go meet weird people like Urania and Pantomorphos, and they will teach you long technical metaphysical lessons. And once you've learned all that, you can go back to Gramesion, which is kind of like an Eden, and you will then be able to shape the body of man. Okay, strange. But your readers will remember that the end of Out of the Silent Planet ends with a postscript in which the fictional beginning of this was the character of Lewis writing to the character of Ransom and saying, hey, have you ever come across this strange 12th century Latin word from Bernard Silvestris called oiarsis? And so that's a great example of in which Lewis takes this book, which is kind of a train wreck by our contemporary standards. It's so weird. But then takes it and rehabilitates it and turns it into modern sci-fi space travel. And he didn't want what was good in it. He didn't want, in some sense, the strong spiritual impulse in it to be lost on readers just because it was old.
Oh, fascinating. Again, the book from Jason is The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis. And before moving on, let's pause and give you a chance to tell a little bit more about yourself. When did you first encounter Lewis, and tell more about your vocational background?
Yeah, I think probably like a lot of your readers, I started reading Lewis as a teenager. And I think he was, you know, the most intellectually weighty and nourishing thing that I knew of at that time, and loved it. And I think I was moved by Lewis because of what a good psychologist he is. That is how he does such a good job of lovingly and playfully and winsomely getting us to acknowledge our own tendencies to self-deception and coming to those moments. And as he describes in Till We Have Faces, and I write about this a little bit, coming to these moments of unveiling, in which I'm forced to come to the difficult moment of recognizing my own tendencies and letting myself be known to myself as well as to God. I think I loved that even as a teenager and found it deeply nourishing. But I think another thing I love about Lewis, and I think this has really influenced how I teach as well as how I write, is this neat idea of always rotating back and forth between looking at the beam and looking along the beam, or this idea of enjoyment and contemplation, or this idea of fact gathering. And you got to do that as a college professor, don't you? You got to give some facts to your students. You got to give some dates. You got to give some terms. But you'd be a failure as a college professor, and probably as a writer too, if you just gave a heap of facts on a page or in a classroom. And so I think one of the things that I love about Lewis, and this I think has actually shaped the way I think about my own vocation, is I haven't considered myself successful until I've both analytically thought about something, but then managed to work myself into feeling why it felt to the original audience as worthy of being put forward in the first place. So I think this kind of rotation of looking along the beam, looking at the beam, as Lewis puts it in Meditations in the Toolshed, might, in addition to just sort of stuff, I think I've sort of accidentally apprenticed myself to Lewis in that way. That I don't consider myself having been successful as a teacher, as a writer, until I've actually made people feel what I've tried to describe.
Oh, okay. Now, I don't think I caught if you mentioned where you teach.
I teach at Wyoming Catholic College. Yeah, where I'm an associate professor. It's a great book school. And so when you work at a small college that does great books, you get to do a million things. And so I teach Homer and Plato and Dante and Augustine and Boethius. And right now I'm even teaching the modern novel, where I'm reading Brothers Karamazov with my students. But I also teach art history, in which I go from Greece to Makoto Fujimura, a contemporary Japanese painter. So it's been a delight of being able to graze in the pastures of literature and art I've been here for 12 years.
Okay. Well, now, speaking more generally about your book, what was the most enjoyable part about writing it, and what was the most challenging?
I think the most challenging, maybe I think this is the part where what you forget as a writer, at least I do. For me, I think the most exciting thing is just to come up with something to say. And you come up with these fabulous sort of discovery moments. So for me, a discovery moment. I discovered that this wonderful distinction that Lewis makes between contemplation and enjoyment, which he got from one of his favorite authors, Samuel Alexander, and then completely haunts all of his writing, and is, as your readers, your listeners will know, Surprised by Joy. I discovered that it's also in Boethius. And not only is it in Boethius, but Lewis comments on it in some of his academic writing. So this moment, which felt kind of cool and up to date, 20th century psychology at its best, has its roots in a 6th century author. That might've been my single favorite sort of discovery moment. I think my single favorite passage is at the conclusion of chapter one, where I'm writing about the cathedral and what it felt like to be in a cathedral, how it felt like it was haunted, but in a good sense, with a positive valence. I think that last page, I love that page. And when I listened to Simon Vance, who I think is the best reader of all time, read that section, it was such a great moment that I had forgotten that I wrote it. I just thought, Simon Vance, that's a great point. And then I realized, oh yeah, I had the privilege of writing that. So I think there's something sort of special, in the whole sort of bookmaking process, that once you've given it over to the editors and they tinker with it, and you've given it to the designers and they come up with an image for you for the cover, and then, you know, they find a reader for you, and it just goes out of your hands. In some sense, you all of a sudden, your own individuality sort of evaporates into this whole kind of team of people who have made it a really cool project. And again, for me, I think to have an awesome reader about like Simon Vance was just great. I think the most challenging thing was getting a really nasty, discouraging review from a reviewer in the early stages in the manuscript. And man, I spent at least a week being mad at him or her. I don't know who it was. It was a nasty review. And it really discouraged me. And I felt like I just wanted to just delete the Microsoft Word document. And I went about it starting to rewrite. I was a little bit mad at first. And I realized that I was able to articulate things four times better because of the sharp, piquant criticism of the reviewer, such that now I've actually come around and wondered, wait a minute, maybe this reviewer was actually being really charitable, said something forceful and scathing enough in order to get me to really feel that I need to make this better. So I think that was a challenging time in which I was frustrated. I was a little discouraged. I was tempted to despair. But in the end, I want to go find this reviewer and give him or her a hug and say, thanks. You, your caustic words made this book at least 42% better.
Ah, yes. Yeah. When you were talking about that, that made me think in terms of, you know, we want to be like stronger, better, but we don't want the challenge in order to go through that process. Many, many years ago, I ran track. And of course, if you wanted to be faster, stronger, you had to go through that challenging, difficult time. And so that's what can make it better if you allow the Lord to speak to you through it and to respond properly.
Yes, my anonymous British, because I could tell because of the spelling, coach was helping me achieve my best despite myself from across the Atlantic.
Now, getting back more specifically to your book, and I haven't mentioned it quite yet, but a friend of mine, Levi Liberta, he read it to help me to come up with some questions because he's actually just finished high school, and I knew this was an interest of his, and so he helped me with some questions. And then he refers back to your third chapter where you write, quote, "The whole world picture had changed from the slow, contemplative, symphonic world to the world of speed, Brussels, and machine." And so then he wants to ask here, how would Lewis inhabit or even speedier times? Wondering, would, you know, in your opinion, I'm sure everyone might have an opinion, but what is your thoughts on, would Lewis be on Facebook or Twitter? Would he have a blog online?
My first thought was absolutely not. There's no way. And I think some of my favorite things to write was exactly that. The From Symphony to Machine chapter, which you were quoting, chapter three, which begins, "Strange as it may sound, Lewis hated cars and newspapers. What are for most of us, the banal and indispensable necessities of daily life were for Lewis sacraments of modernity." And he writes about, you know, driving around in cars and what it steals from you. And Alan Jacobs points out in his great book that Lewis was even suspicious of zippers and would have his pants tailor-made with buttons for the fly. You're like, I don't know if that's a good idea. But so my first thought was, there's no way Facebook, Twitter, online blogging. My second thought was, yeah, but he loved radio. As much as he critiqued it, he did it. he participated in it, and he brought a sense of depth. And so with that as a more nuanced thought, I thought, well, maybe Lewis would try to use the mediums intelligently. But I think here's the big thing. I think it's easy to use these mediums where you try to amp up your image without having the depth and the solidity behind it. And I think it's really easy for us to, I mean, we live in an age of sort of, you know, flotsam and jetsam, of just sort of floating along the sort of stream of our own consciousness, in which we're, I mean, everyone knows this feeling, right? We're so distractible and we're constantly touching our devices. And you know what researchers say, like several hundred touches a day, right? Maybe even more, in which we're almost kind of, we've lost a sense of inner stillness. So I suppose what I'd like to say is that maybe Lewis would participate in these media, but he would exercise some sort of personal discipline or some kind of, you know, parameters of rules in which he wouldn't let these things take over his mind, such that he was checking his own stuff and his own analytics and his own retweets and his own shares and these kind of stuff every 15 minutes. So that, because I think for him, what was really precious was this sense of inner tranquility, this ability to be alone, this ability to be still, this ability to be in front of God without having his mind wander. So I think if he could do something like that, and again, I don't want to compare myself to a great man like Lewis, who I feel about Lewis, I think the way that Dante felt about Virgil, right? That here's my better. If he gave me a word of praise, I would blush with happiness. So not to compare myself to a great man, but one little thing that I've just done on my own phone is that I killed all of its apps except my audiobook app, texting and calling. And so I found my usage time went way down. But most importantly, I found that I wasn't constantly distracted and fearful, and not fearful, but just sort of anxious to feel up to date and in the know. I think Lewis was a very keen diagnostician of that tendency in modernity to live, if this makes sense, to live on the periphery of our being, to be constantly distracting ourselves from distraction with so much stuff and clutter that we lose the capacity for what he calls, borrowing from the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, that I-you relationship, which requires a lot of stillness and a lot of attentiveness. So it'd be fun to get him into this conversation. But my feeling is he might blog, and I bet he'd be willing to do podcasts for sure. I don't know if he would do Facebook or Twitter, because I think he'd be nervous about, like I said, that temptation to lose a sense of inner stillness.
Okay, right. Yeah. Just a quick correction, a minor correction in terms of your reference to radio. I don't know if you caught yourself saying that Lewis loved radio. He didn't love radio in one sense in terms of like listening to it. In fact, he's known to have discouraged people from listening to radio, ironically. But he did appreciate the impact that it had, which is why he did, you know, go on radio so many times when he did that.
Exactly. I think that might be a good guiding principle to think through Lewis's possible participation in Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah. Well, now,
definitely not Instagram.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No chance.
Or TikTok.
Yeah.
But now, speaking of online presence, I'm aware that you do have a website, and it's been noted already that you've written other books. So tell us briefly about your site on the internet and a little bit about your other books.
Yes. JasonMBaxter.com. JasonMBaxter.com is my site. It was just an attempt for me to collect some of my media appearances and some of my online writing, in addition to my scholarly work on Dante and Lewis, and I've written a book on Christian mysticism. I try to do some writing on a kind of unique approach to travel writing, in which I use some of my own traveling experiences to reflect on literature and vice versa. I've got some of that stuff on up there. And I jokingly say for those who want to go indie or go vinyl, I sell some of my own books and I'm willing to sign them and ship them out, even though I know trillionaire companies need to eat too, right? So, you know, you can go to the big sites, but I also sell my books up there online. I've written, in addition to this Lewis book, I wrote a book which came out with Baker last year called An Introduction to Christian Mysticism, which is something about sort of why we need pre-modern Christian authors' reflection on prayer and God and mysticism in our modern age. I also wrote another book with Baker called A Beginner's Guide to Dante, which I'm happy to say is used in high school classrooms and book clubs and book groups and college classrooms as a way of being both trying to take Dante seriously in terms of the intellectual depth, but also presented in a sort of way that it's moving to a contemporary audience. Yeah, so all those things are on the site.
Oh, great. Now, thinking more back to the current book here that we're talking about, which is, again, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, how should modern people consider the cosmos? How can someone synchronize the medieval picture, which Lewis loved so much, along with the facts of modern discoveries?
Right. And I think this might be one of the most exciting and perhaps most surprising aspects of Lewis. He's got a great little dialogue between a believer and an anonymous agnostic or atheist, in which the atheist or agnostic critiques Lewis for always referring to all those old chaps like Dante and Aquinas and all of his beloved medieval authors. And in this imagined dialogue, Lewis, seemingly they're sitting in their offices in Oxford, pulls a book off the shelf, hands it to his friend and says, "Read that." And he reads this little chunk from Ptolemy that describes the earth as being so small, it's like an infinitesimally small point within the cosmos. And this agnostic slash atheist looks up at Lewis or the religious interlocutor in this little dialogue and says, "Did they really believe that then?" And so Lewis, one of the cool things that Lewis knew and talked about with some frequency is that the medieval understanding of the cosmos is more compatible with our modern understanding than you might think, particularly the post-Newtonian world. As I like to say, and I have a chapter on this on Lewis and science, the post-Newtonian world, our world of quantum physics and astrophysics and cosmology is a world of deep space and deep time. In fact, I was reading a book the other day by Frank Close, it's one of the Oxford Shorter Guides on Particle Accelerators. And Frank Close says, the human being is this fascinating figure who's sort of halfway between infinitely small infinities of molecular biology and infinitely large infinities of cosmology and astrophysics. Now, I don't know if Frank Close knew that he was doing this, but he's basically quoting Pascal from the 17th century, who says that man is between these two types of infinities. So I think Lewis very astutely knew that the medieval cosmos was more up to date. It was stranger. It had more variety. I mean, we live in a world of black holes and neutron stars and neutrinos and all these kinds of things. Our world is really weird. Our postmodern cosmology is exciting, fabulous, almost mythological. And that way, even though the details of the science have changed, I think what you could say is the philosophy of science of pre-1500 and the philosophy of science of sort of post, 1900 are really similar, even though some of the empirical details have changed. That's a delightful aspect of Lewis. And that in some ways, it creates this opportunity for a dialogue in which our medieval authors have something to tell us in our modernity.
Well, now, to close here, let's have you do a final recap of your book for those maybe still on the fence about why it's important to understand the medieval mind of C.S. Lewis.
Everyone loves a good book on the Inklings. if you love Lewis, you can't help but loving Owen Barfield, as difficult he is, or Tolkien, or, you know, some of these other figures that we know less about, you know, a Charles Williams or a Dyson, right? Everyone loves a good book. I mean, Humphrey Carpenter's book on the Inklings is so good. You can't get bored with that. Why? Because if you love Lewis, you want to know his friends. You want to see how he lived out his friendships, which was so intellectual, right? And you want to hear about the conversations that they had on their Tuesday nights and their walking trips. I think the cool thing about Lewis, and this is what the book is about, is that in a way you could imaginatively expand the circle of the Inklings to include long dead people. That in Lewis's mind, that right, he's not a chronological snob, as he accuses modernity of. In Lewis's mind, Boethius and Dante and Plato and Aquinas, as well as other figures like the theologian Hooker or Thomas Traherne, are as vital friends, despite the fact that they never overlapped in their own chronologies, as his buddies at The Bird and the Baby.
Well, again, we encourage people to consider Jason's book, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis. Jason, thank you very much for joining me on All About Jack.
William, I appreciate your questions. This has been a lot of fun.
I also want to thank you, the listener, for joining me for this episode of All About Jack, one of the many resources from the website EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of this show. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series new for 2022 called Weekly Dose of C.S. Lewis Quotes. In addition to previous episodes of All About Jack on my website, you can find various articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he may not have written. I also have a YouTube channel called Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. This has a visual edition of the weekly quotes as well as other content. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today you heard an interview with Dr. Jason M. Baxter. It was about the book, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis. You'll find a link in the show notes about getting a copy, along with other related links. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.